Sorry, are we on?
Yeah, red dots there.
So. Good, thank you. So, the purpose of today's class, well, the official purpose is to talk about Jacobian changes of variables, but I'm going to do it exactly to the extent so as to have all the tools to solve the following riddle. The riddle looks awful, but when you actually try to do it, it's even more awful. but then the conclusion is amazing. The conclusion is truly amazing, so it's worth the effort. Anyway, so here's the riddle. And again, I'm only mentioning it because, well, it's kind of a nice way to motivate doing Gaussian integration in five dimensions and things like that. But anyway, so basically you take, these are not circles. They are circles on my screen, but the projector kills it, okay? So you put 2 to the n circles on the vertices of the cube minus 1, 1 to the n, okay? So basically one circle, or basically one at minus 1, minus 1, 1 at minus 1, 1, 1 at 1, minus 1, 1 at 1, 1, okay? And then you consider two things. The box Bn, which is the smallest box that contains these circles. So here it's just a square, here it's a box. In n dimensions, it would be an n-dimensional box. And the biggest ball that is bound by all of these balls, okay? So here it's a two-dimensional ball, here it's a three-dimensional ball, it's blue, it's hiding here. And my question is, what is the limit as n goes to infinity of the volume of the ball divided by the volume of the cube? Okay? And if the answer doesn't shock you, you know nothing. But I'm not going to tell you the answer yet, okay? I'm only going to tell you that the answer will shock you. Okay. Okay? Good. So let's start. So let me remind you. Where we were. So we were starting the discussion of the change of variables theorem, which says the following. So Jihad, can I ask you to try to get chalk from somewhere? There's just no chalk in the room other than like the few small chunks that are. Thank you.
Legally or illegally?
I honestly don't care. Be careful with the next. Okay. So let G from A to B be a diffeomorphism. Oh my god, you know already that I don't know how to spell large, long words, right? So let it be a diffeo, and you can add the word morphism at the end if you wish, of open sets. Of open sets, meaning A and B are open. Again, what does diffeomorphism mean? It means one-to-one, onto C1, and inverse is C1. So basically, equivalence in the world of differentiable things. Let f be a function from b to r. Then f is integrable on b if and only if f composed with g multiplied by the Jacobian of the diffeomorphism G is integrable on A And I should remind you what is the Jacobian. So, so the Jacobian of G at some point x, so maybe I'll draw a picture. Here is A, here is B, and we have a further map, so there is a map G between them, and we have a further map into the real numbers. And, well, the map G has a differential, and the differential is just, so at any point of A, the differential is the best approximation you can think of for the best linear, for the linear functions that best approximates G at this point. Okay? And then, so both of these are domains in Rn. I should have said that in the statement. Did I? I forgot to say it. Open sets in Rn. And then the differential will be an n by n matrix. And so the Jacobian is defined to be the absolute value of the determinant of that matrix. Okay, so that was the reminder, and now I continue the statement of the theorem. So if and only, so the two functions are integrable if and only if, so at the same time, one is integrable if and only if the other is, and furthermore, and if they are integrable, the integrals are equal. Meaning the integral over B of F, so the integral over B of F is equal to, well, the integral of the functions that you get on N by taking F composed with G and multiplying it by the Jacobian. Now, so what I want to do today is to show you a few applications, but even before that, I want to give you a plausibility argument. So I'm not going to give you a proof, and in fact, most likely I'm going to skip the proof altogether in this class, and only show a plausibility argument. The proof is most of it, so parts of it gets reused elsewhere, and when we get to these parts, we may go back to them. But most of the proof is kind of tools that you use only for the purpose of this theorem and never get to use again. So if there is something that I should skip, it's this. Okay? Also, the geometric argument for why this is true is sufficiently clear that, you know, you don't lose much by omitting the proof. Okay, so, and by the way, in general, so we're going to be a little less rigorous when it comes to epsilons and deltas, so precise proofs using epsilons and deltas, And the rigor will move elsewhere. So we're going to be a bit more, or not more rigorous, but sort of a different type of rigor will enter when we start talking about differential forms. It will be more like linear algebra style of rigor. So more geometric and more differential geometric style of rigor, you will see. But the emphasis will slightly shift. Anyway, so first of all, why is this true? Okay? So, why true? So, again, I will say it imprecisely, okay? So, first of all, what is the integral of a function, let's say this function? What is the integral of, you know, in general, what is the integral of, you know what, let's start with this one. What is the, which one is better? I'm not sure. So what's the integral of a function f on a domain V? So so precisely, it was defined as a certain supremum of
So this is the extended integral. So supremum over integrals over rectifiable sets, each of which is a supremum of lower sums or an infimum of upper sums, G, extremely complicated thing. But what is it really? Okay? So really, you take the domain, you divide it into rectangles. Here I divided only a part of the domain, so I suppose I have to divide, thank you. And I suppose I have to divide the rest. So basically you take the whole domain, you write it as a union of rectangles, or approximately as a union of rectangles. Maybe some rectangles will go a little bit over, or a little bit, or maybe parts of the domain you will miss, but you will more or less cover the domain with rectangles. So you write D is equal to, so not equal, but more or less equal to the union of many, many rectangles. And then this becomes this approximately equal to the sum over all of the rectangles of, for each rectangle, the volume of that rectangle times the value of the function at some point inside the rectangle. So the lower sums are defined by the infimum, the upper sums are defined by the supremum, but basically if the function is nearly continuous, so mostly continuous, then there is not going to be much of a difference between the infimum and the supremum, so I can just write here f of xi, where xi is some point in the rectangle. So, again, this is not precisely the integral, but if you make this approximation better and better, and if you make this approximation, so basically if you make these rectangles smaller and smaller, and you make the unions of the rectangles closer and closer to the set you want to integrate on, this is going to get closer and closer to the integral. Okay? Now, here is one modification that I could have done and that I didn't do and I might want to do later, and it's the following. Instead of rectangles, I could have used parallelograms. So instead of, same thing, instead of using rectangles, I could have used, I could have subdivided it using some other grid, and then use parallelograms. Okay? And in fact, I could have been even more loose. I could have used rectangles for part of the picture and parallelograms for another part of the picture. Or I could have slowly deformed from using parallelograms to using rectangles. The idea would remain the same, and I would get that the integral over B of f. So now maybe I should call this PI for parallelogram number I, not partition I, and the integral of over B of F will be more or less equal to the sum over I, the volume of the I-th parallelogram times F at a point xi, where xi belongs to the I-th parallelogram. Okay? Okay. Now, let's start looking at our picture. Okay, so, I actually already wrote what the integral over B is. So, but maybe I'll repeat it. So here is A, here is G, here is B. I have a function F into R. I want to tell you what the integral over B of F is. So I subdivide B into parallelograms. Well, I wrote rectangles, but it could have been parallelograms just as well. So I subdivide it into many, many parallelograms. And then I write the integral is equal to the sum over all over all I of the volume of Pi times the value of the function f on a point yi, where yi belongs to Pi. Why did I switch to yi? It's because I want to use y here and x here. That's all. Okay? So, and again, this is not an equality, it's an approximate equality, and the approximation becomes better and better the smaller the rectangles are, or the parallelograms are. Okay, now take this picture here and pull it back to here. So, well, you have a picture, you have a function, G inverse, and take each, basically take each parallelogram here and turn it into a parallelogram here, or turn it into a shape here. What will this shape look like? Okay? So, globally, G may deform things, okay? But locally, in the small scale, G is differentiable, so it's approximated pretty well by its differential. So, in the small scale, a rectangle here will be pulled back to a by a linear function. And the image via a linear function of a rectangle is a parallelogram. Or if you started from parallelograms here, the image of a parallelogram by a linear function is again a parallelogram. So basically, or said differently, these straight lines, when you pull them back, will no longer be straight. Nevertheless, these rectangles will become shapes that are very close to parallelograms over here. Okay? So now, okay, also I can pull back each of the yi's to a point here. So I have points xi here, which go to the corresponding yi's. So I have xi's inside the domain N, such that g of xi is equal to yi. And the domain A is more or less subdivided into a union of, what should I call them, pi prime, where the pi primes are nearly parallelograms. Nearly, oh my god, now I need to spell parallelograms. Parallelograms. Okay? Okay, so now let me write let me continue this formula. So, this becomes the sum of the volume of Pi times, well, instead of f at yi, I can write that yi is equal to g of xy. So it's f of g of xi, or said differently, f composed g at xi. But you see, this now almost looks like a formula for an integral computed on A. Right? It's a sum of volumes times values. The only problem is that it's the wrong volume. Here, I'm taking the volume of Pi, the parallelogram that's here. But if I wanted it to be an integral on A, I would have needed to use the volumes of the parallelogram in A, the parallelograms in A. Okay? So let's manipulate it. So this is equal to the sum over I of the volume of pi prime. Remember, pi prime is the parallelogram that, well, the pre-image of the parallelogram pi. It's a parallelogram here. So pi primes live here. Times, well, now let's multiply and divide to fix it. So volume of pi, the volume divided by the volume of pi prime, times f circle g at xi. Okay? Are you with me? So I did nothing. I only multiplied and divided. Okay? But now I need a little lemma. So, lemma. No, it's more than a lemma. I'll call it a lemma, but it's the key lemma. It's the key to everything. Key lemma. So, if you have a linear map, if L is a linear map from Rn to Rn, is linear, and P prime is a parallelogram, I hope I'm spelling it right, in Rn, then the volume of the image of P prime, so the volume of L of P prime is equal to the absolute value of the determinant of L times the volume of P prime. Okay, so why do I like this lemma so much? So first of all, you know, you've seen determinants in linear algebra, and you must have seen them as formal constructs. They were constructed formally, but what do they measure? What do they do? Here is what they do. Okay? This explains determinants. That's much, in a way, it's much more valuable than the particular minor place where we're going to use it. Okay? A determinant, the determinant of a linear factor, of a linear transformation, is the factor by which it stretches volume. Right? If you have a map, basically again, if you have a map from one space to another, you take a parallelogram here, you map it to a parallelogram here, the new parallelogram will have a different volume than this one. The determinant measures by how much the volume stretches. Okay? So, I mean, I think this in itself makes determinants much more valuable than you might have thought they were. And, okay. And now, the rest of the proof, the analytic details, I don't feel terribly compelled to show. Okay? However, this key lemma, I will definitely prove. This key lemma is too structural to let it just be. Okay, I have to explain why this is true. Anyway, given this lemma, what do I have here? I have that this is equal to sum over I of the volume of pi prime times the volume of, okay, how are pi and pi prime related? So pi is the image via the map G of pi prime, right? I have pi primes on the left, and the map G maps it to a parallelogram pi. But the map G is very closely approximated by its differential. So up to a very close approximation, and again, the details are exactly what I'm omitting right now, this is the volume of the differential of G at where? At some point, well, again, the differential of G changes, but it changes relatively slowly. So I can choose any point I wish inside pi prime and compute the differentials there. Right? The differential globally changes, but within a small parallelogram, it's not going to change much. So the volume of the differential of G at xi, so now that's a linear map, and I apply it to pi prime, and divide by the volume of pi prime, times f circle g of xi. Okay, but now, this is the volume after applying the linear map divided by volume before applying the linear map, so it's exactly this divided by that, and the result is the determinant. Well, and the determinant is what I call the Jacobian. So this is sum over I, volume of pi prime, times the Jacobian of g at the point xi, times f circle g at the point xi. But this is simply the formula, right? Or at least the approximate formula for the integral over a of f circle g multiplied by the Jacobian. And that's the end of the proof. Okay? So basically, what is the proof? The proof is on tiny rectangles or parallelograms, volumes are stretched by the determinant. And if you have a large domain, it's just subdivided into many pieces, on each of which the volume is stretched by that amount. So instead of integrating f circle g, you integrate f circle g times the stretching factor. And that's it. Okay? So again, I definitely owe you a proof of the key lemma. I'm not sure if I will ever go back and turn this into a formal proof. Okay. But I still want to use it. So the next thing is example. Over r squared of e to the minus x squared plus y squared over 2 dx dy, meaning relative to the bar of what you know what it means. Okay, so let's start working on it. Okay, so attempt one. If I write attempt 1, you already know it's going to fail, right? Otherwise, why would I be writing? Okay? So anyway, attempt 1, use the techniques that we already have from before this class. So use Fubini. So this integral, what should I call it? I don't know, maybe I'll be creative and call it G2. Okay? So G2 is equal to, let's see, the integral relative to x of the integral relative to y of e to the, so the same function, right? But e to the sum is the, right, the exponential of the sum is the product of the exponential, so I write it as e to the minus x squared over 2, e to the minus y squared over 2. But now, the integral dy, the integral relative to the variable y, sees only this function. From the perspective of y, this is a constant. So it's the integral of a constant times something, so I can pull the constant out. So this is equal to the integral dx e to the minus x squared over 2 of the integral dy of e to the minus y squared over 2. But now, this quantity no longer depends on x. It's just a constant. I don't know what it is, but it's just a constant. Now let's be creative and call it g1. So what did we get? We get the integral relative to x of e to the minus x squared times g1, but g1 is a constant, so I can pull it out of the integration. So it's g1. So it's this. But now what is this integral? This integral is exactly the same as that integral. I only changed the name of the variable from x to y. So this is equal to g1 times g1, also known as g1 squared, where g1 is equal to the integral from minus infinity to infinity relative to x e to the minus x squared over 2. And I didn't leave myself enough space to write. That this is the most important integral in mathematics. Or at least in the most important definite integral in mathematics. Maybe the most important integral of mathematics is something like the integral of x to the n is equal to, I don't know, something else. But I mean, this is at least the most important definite integral in math. Why? Okay? Well, first of all, we haven't computed it, okay? But it's the most important integral. Why? So first of all, you may have seen the Gaussian distribution before. So this is exactly, well, this is the function that defines the Gaussian distribution. So the graph looks like this. So this is the graph of e to the minus x squared over 2. And it's the so-called normal distribution or bell curve. And basically, any place where you study statistics, you have to study the integral of this. Also, it appears in the quantum mechanics. Well, let me say, it's equally fundamental in quantum mechanics. You can't even think about quantum field theory without knowing this integral. So in several ways, it's an extremely important integral. Plus, we will use it later today for other things. Anyway, but we still don't know what it is. Okay, we only know that G2 is the square of our thing, but how does this help us? Okay, so that was attempt number two. And now let's do, attempt one. Now let's do attempt two. So I want to integrate something over the entire R2. The something just happens to be the function e to the minus x squared plus y squared over 2. Okay? What I will do is I will change coordinates to so-called polar coordinates. What are polar coordinates? So polar coordinates are, for a point xy here, its polar coordinates are the distance to the origin r, and the angle theta between the positive x-axis and the vector to that point. I'm sure you've seen it. So, what does it really mean? It means that here I look at a domain of the following shape. So r can go from 0 to infinity, and theta can go between 0 and 2 pi. So theta runs from 0 to 2 pi. I have a domain that looks like this inside r2 of r and theta. This is r2 of x and y. And any point here, so any pair r comma theta here, corresponds to a point here using, well, this description. But what does it mean precisely? Precisely, it means that I have a map G going from here to here, where G is defined by G of r and theta are the x and the y of the point whose description is this. But this you know. So this is r cosine theta, r sine theta. Okay? Now, so I'm planning to use the change of variables formula. And if I'm planning to use the change of variables formula, then first thing I will want to do is to compute the Jacobian of this function. So let's do it. So the Jacobian of the function g, so to be precise, the Jacobian is in itself a function of a point, right? So it's a function of a pair r theta, is equal to, so the absolute value of the determinant of the differential of this function. What is the differential of this function? I hope I remember. It's the derivative of both of these things relative to r. So cosine theta, sine theta, and then the derivative of both of these things relative to theta. So negative r sine theta, r cosine theta. Do I remember my, did I differentiate, is this correct trigonometric differentiation? Good. Well, okay, this determinant I can do. Cosine times cosine is cosine squared minus sine squared, that gives 1. So the only thing that's left is this r. So this is equal to the absolute value of r. But since r was always positive, it's just equal to r itself. Okay? So therefore, the original integral, so g2, is equal to the integral over this r2, or this plane. So the integral over, so r runs from 0 to infinity, so this is where r goes, and theta runs from 0 to 2 pi, of the function you get by composing f with g, times the Jacobian. So maybe on the side I should compute what is f composed with g. So f composed with g at r comma theta is e to the minus, okay, now I need to, instead of x squared, I need to put r cosine theta. So e to the minus r cosine theta squared minus, plus r sine theta squared, all of this divided by 2. Right, I just took the original function and put x and y equal these two things. But again, here I have cosine squared plus sine squared, that's 1. So this is e to the minus r squared over 2. So here the thing I need to integrate is e to the minus r squared over 2. Sorry, times the Jacobian. That, right, I'm still using the change of variables formula, so times r. Okay, what is this? So let's do, doing the integral with respect to theta is completely trivial. Now I do use Fubini. Now, doing the integral with respect to theta is completely trivial. With respect to, this is simply independent of theta. So the integral with respect to theta does nothing except multiply by the length of the interval. So I get 2 pi times the integral from 0 to infinity, but now only relative to the variable r, r times e to the minus r squared over 2. But now, this, luckily, is a derivative. So you see, the original g1, the original integral we wanted to compute, maybe I should have started with this, the first thing I would have wanted to do would be to find an antiderivative. But you're welcome to search, you cannot find an antiderivative. In fact, you can prove that there is no closed formula for an antiderivative. Okay? However, this very clearly has an antiderivative, namely, if you take e to the minus r squared over 2, the derivative of this is, well, the derivative of the exponential is the exponential, and then you have to multiply by the internal derivative. That's 2r divided by 2, that gives you the r, and I only have an extra minus sign. So the antiderivative of this is minus that. So in other words, the derivative of this function is that. So therefore, our integral is equal to 2 pi times, the antiderivative minus e to the minus r squared over 2 evaluated from 0 to infinity. And this is, so let's see, at infinity you get, okay, so this is 2 pi times, at infinity this goes to 0, so you get 0, minus at 0, this goes to, this is 1, but I have a minus sign, so it's minus minus 1, so the answer is 2 pi. And so the conclusion, okay, so we're done. G2 was just computed, and it comes out to be 2 pi. Secretly, what I really wanted to compute was G1, right? I started from G2, but my real goal was to compute the most important integral in mathematics. But you see, my failed attempt gave me that G2 is equal to G1 squared. So the conclusion is that the most important integral in mathematics, G1, is the square root of what is written here, which is 2 pi. So, one reason why this is lovely is because you don't often see, or this is the loveliest example I know, one of the loveliest examples I know of a one-dimensional problem which is best solved by going into two dimensions. I guess we had another example, right? Somewhere when we differentiated, we found that the best way to differentiate x times x was to x to the power x was to use multivariable calculus. And in a similar way, G1 is a single variable integration problem, but the only way I know how to compute it is to switch to two variables and use the change of variables formula in two variables. So that's lovely in itself. There is a second reason why it's lovely. Let me tell you about it. So now I have to be even more informal. So, first of all, you know, I did lots of calculations and came to this answer, which then I evaluated, but I came to here by doing lots of calculations. I want to get to the same place intuitively, but without calculations, or with fewer calculations. So basically, I am trying to integrate the function e to the minus x squared plus y squared over 2. But what is this function? So, you know, maybe I should change names from x squared plus y squared to x1 and x2 and change the names of the coordinates to x1 and x2. And then x1 squared plus x2 squared, well, now I can give a common name to x1 and x2. And the sum of the squares is exactly the Euclidean norm, or the square of the Euclidean norm. So this is e to the minus the Euclidean norm squared over 2. But the Euclidean norm is just the distance from the origin, and it's rotation invariant. It doesn't change if I rotate the picture. So basically, the function we are looking at is constant on concentric circles, right? So if you are on a circle of radius r, the function is going to be constant on that circle. So the integral over r2 of f will be, so a different way to compute it, instead of, So what's the integral? The integral is the value of the function times the volume of the of some small domain. Okay? So instead of partitioning it into squares, I will partition it into annuli. I will partition it into very, very, very thin annuli. Okay? And then the value of the function will be, the integral will be the sum over all such annuli of the function f on each such annulus times the area of each individual annulus. Okay? Now, suppose the annulus is of width dr. So suppose the annulus is, well, starting at position r, and the width of the annulus is dr. Then this will be a sum over all annuli, or such annuli, of f at that annuli. F of this annulus is e to the minus r squared over 2 on that particular annulus, times, well, the area of such an annulus. But what's the area of such an annulus? It's the length of a circle, okay? So it's the volume of a circle of radius r times dr. And now, or you know what, maybe I should have called it delta r, and call this delta r2. And now, do the usual thing. So again, this is only approximately equal. And now do the usual thing and replace a sum by an integral. So this will be the integral relative to the variable r of e to the minus r squared over 2 times, okay, what's the volume of a circle of radius r? 2 pi r, I believe.
So that's okay. The circumference.
That is the volume of a circle. The volume of a set, okay, the length of the set, if you wish. The volume of the annulus is the length of the circle. And in one dimension,
Right.
Volume means length.
Yeah, sorry. So it's not okay. It's not actually like the area of the circle. It's the area.
No, it's not the area of the disc. It's the length of the circle.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. I'm out of time. We did start a few minutes early, as a few minutes late. So I'll go 2 minutes further. Okay. The point is that this can be generalized to any dimension. So this can be generalized to any dimension, and basically you can define Gn to be the integral on Rn of e to the minus x squared over 2, and using Fubini in exactly the same way as before, you find that this is g1 to the power n, meaning it's 2 pi to the power n over 2. On the other hand, using the exact same reasoning, but scaled to dimension n, you find that this is the integral from 0 to infinity, d, the radius, but now the things we're looking at are not circles, but sort of spherical shells. So it's dr times e to the minus r squared over 2 times the volume of an n-dimensional, n minus 1-dimensional sphere of radius r. Okay? But simply by scaling, since the dimension here is n minus 1, this is equal to the integral from 0 to r, dr, r to the n minus 1, e to the minus, sorry, I should have done it in the opposite order. So e to the minus r squared over 2, r to the n minus 1, times the volume of in the n minus 1 dimensional sphere of radius 1. But now I have an equation that allows me to compute what is the volume of the n minus 1 dimensional sphere. And it's not very hard, if you know the volume of an n minus 1 dimensional sphere, to deduce the volume of the n minus of the n dimensional ball. So now you have all the tools to solve this riddle. And that was where I wanted to go. So I think on Monday, I will try to give a few more details about that, but also and also the key lemma. Okay, so time to turn off the video. Okay, so